Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us. Jim and Austin, welcome this morning. We've been seeing a lot of press about the Arab Spring and what's happening there. I know recently we just did an article on the new Nazi party in Egypt, and it started me wondering what the Arab summer is going to be like. Are we going to see a shift from this joyous type of we're all happy, we're all going to be democratic groups, and shifting into something more nefarious?
It's going to go from happy to hot. You're already seeing that. The three Arab states that are still fighting, that's Syria, Yemen, and Libya, are going to be fighting even more intensively, and they're basically encouraging each other. It's not that there's a lot of direct communication between those three countries, but each of them takes, you know, inspiration, as it were, encouragement from the fact that the other two are still fighting. It's the hardest fight, as it were, in Syria, as we explained recently in Strategy Page. But each of them have the same mix of religious, tribal, and in some cases ethnic, you know, differences that their dictators had manipulated for decades, as dictators have been doing, you know, and kings have been doing for thousands of years. But because of mass communications in the last 50 years, and especially the arrival of the Internet, more of the people in these countries are aware of how they've been played. I mean, for a long time, I mean, you can imagine many of these countries where there wasn't even radio 40, you know, or so years ago, or in some parts of these countries, you know, less. You know, people were depending upon gossip, you know, people coming in from places that had radio or possibly television, and it was all hearsay. As far as they were concerned, keep your head down, you know, keep raising enough food to survive another year, and then life goes on. That's no longer the case. The kids know that there's another world out there, and it's a much better one than what they're stuck with. Now they also know that other people in situations like theirs have fought and won a better world. And it's not a good idea to underestimate how powerful an impact this is having on, you know, the people, especially the younger people, who don't realize that they're not bulletproof, you know, are having out there. It is changing everything. And the people who have been running things for a long time are finding it out. And from what I've been hearing from intel sources is in all three of those countries, the powers that be are scrambling for a way to get out of their situation solvent and unindicted. And so far, mixed success.
Right. Austin?
I think Jim gives a pretty darn good and succinct summary of the situation. I would not underestimate, and I think a lot of people have, genuine aspirations for modernization that the Arab Spring has expressed. Those expressions, in some ways, they're not new. I mean, you're looking back 90 years, really, 1919, 1920. It was Scotch maybe by 1921 with the imposition completely of Sykes-Picot and the failure of the Treaty of Sevres, ending you know, the division at least of the remnant parts of the Ottoman Empire where the Arabs live, predominantly live. So I would not underestimate that. Jim mentioned the three countries where the fighting is still going on. I'll tell you what, Egypt's going to have a long, hot summer, and the testing ground is going to be the continued cooperation within the Egyptian military. Is the Egyptian military going to remain the disciplined nationalist institution that it has shown it can be, especially with the pressures be placed on members of the senior members of the Egyptian army to support various nefarious factions within Egypt. We're going to know a lot more come September with the Egyptian elections. That's going to be hot politics. I also expect to see continued violent actions. There are going to be Islamist militants are going to launch attacks on Christians. They've been doing that. They'll continue to do that because it gets headlines and it draws, it plays the religious, to the religious differences that Jim noted, that fracture really, that affect all of these countries. Certainly the Shia Sunni in Yemen, Alawite Shia, Shia Sunni Christians in Syria, in Libya, as Jim and I both noted in past strategy talks. You've got the ethnic divisions and tribal divisions. But in Egypt, that differentiation between the Sunni Muslims and the Coptic Christians, that's going to be played upon by the extremists. Tunisia seems right now to be the success story among the group. Went first, and you know we've discussed its interesting and demographics as well as its economic the economic component. It puts Tunisia ahead of at least the other Arab states participating in Arab Spring. But in the last 2 weeks, I've read a number of articles, a couple of them by Tunisians, pointing out, look, we want to see economic changes. We want to see that the old corrupt elites do not re-infiltrate. And there's been several articles that I've read on that. So that the politics there are by no means settled. I mean, some of the essential political problems that were expressed in the Jasmine Revolution. So when you say that, then Jim says that it's going to be a hot summer, happy to hot, I think that's a good way to express it. You got to look at part of the spring, though. Action in Libya has been hot. Action in Syria, it was a hot spring. Still is a hot spring in Syria. Over the long run, what kind of window do you want to put on it, Dan? I mean, you know, I said we'll know a heck of a lot more by September, but what's broken out and what we've seen in the Arab Spring are issues that, you know, I just said a second ago, have at least 9 decades of history behind them. And the problems are not going to be solved quickly, and you're going to have resonance through the next, I don't think I want to underestimate it, the next 5 or 6 decades because of what's going on in 2011. It's going to feed other turmoil. It's going to raise other hopes. It's going to dash some hopes. But the activity of this is a significant year, tremendously significant year for better and for worse.
Now, I noticed that one of the things that Syria did, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, was they tried to push some protesters. I mean, they were pro-Syrian protesters, but they tried to push them into Israel and get some sort of action going between the Israelis and the Syrians. Are the Syrians counting on trying to get a nationalistic feeling of directed towards Israel so they'll get the people off of their own problems inside of Syria?
That didn't work. The problem with the Palestinians has always been that the other Arab countries would not allow them to be refugees, even though they were. They would not allow them to become citizens of countries they moved to. They were always considered, you know, refugees and people apart. They would never absorb any of them. And this basically has become a contentious issue between the Palestinians and the other Arab states. Every country that has an Arab, a Palestinian population, the Palestinians there tend to be separate and hostile towards the country they're in. So what you saw happening on the Syrian border and the Lebanese border were, you know, the foreigners, the foreign Palestinians, as it were, many of whom have been born in Syria or Lebanon, carrying out their own agenda. And most of the, you know, the citizens of, you know, those countries would just assume the Palestinians kept walking, whether they got shot or not. So no, I mean, there may have been some hope on the part of the Syrian government. They certainly didn't get in the way of the Palestinians doing their little, you know, Akba Day, they, you know, disaster day, they, the Arabs called the day that Israel became an independent country. They weren't going to stop them, again, secretly because they'd hoped they'd march and keep marching.
Right. Well, now that's always been, my understanding of history is that part of Jordan was supposed to have been carved out for a Palestinian state at one point, correct?
Yeah, the big, you know, what might have been was the West Bank, which Israel took in the 67 war, was originally part of Jordan, which only gave it up, what, 10, 15 years later, officially gave it up, said we renounce our claims on it, mainly because the Jordanians, Jordan is run by a Bedouin minority, because they're overwhelmed by, well, Palestinians and other Arabs. And they certainly didn't want to be responsible for any more of these Palestinians who were basically very unruly subjects. The tragedy is that Jordan and the West Bank would have been the Palestinian state, you know, give Gaza back to Egypt. But the Jordanians want no part of it. Nobody wants the Palestinians. That's what it comes down to. Nobody likes to say that. But if you look at all that's going on, that's what it comes down to. The Israelis took the West Bank because without the West, look at Israel, you know, without the West Bank, it's very narrow. It's very difficult to defend. You know, anybody with a halfway decent mechanized force, which fortunately for Israel, no Arab state has, even though Egypt has 1,000 M1 tanks, Israel, you know, needs that defense. And that's why Israel isn't quick to give away the settlements or any claims to the West Bank. They need some depth if they're going to defend themselves from some future, you know, aggressor. And all indications are there are plenty of potential future aggressors. Peace with Israel is not breaking out in the Middle East. You only have to look at Arab media to see that. And I'm surprised more Westerners don't. It's on the internet. There's no excuse. You don't have to go buy an Arab language newspaper, although the best, the juiciest stuff, you know, anti-Semitic and, you know, destroy Israel stuff is in Arabic. But I believe Google Translate will translate some of that poison. You know, it's not a perfect translation, but you get the sense of it. But even their English language stuff, you know, is usually pretty clear on what their real objectives are and why all this talk of peace is, as the Arabs like to describe it, as just a ploy to weaken the Israelites a little bit so we can finally destroy them.
Right. Now,
Dan, look.
Go ahead.
One of the things, though, that Syria hoped out of that sally forth of a probe of Israel with Palestinians is the demonization angle. The rulers, tribal chieftains, they're fractured themselves, but the Arabs seek unity in the demonization of Israel. And look, there have been several attempts by Islamist militants in Egypt. And in Gaza and in Syria as well to try to shift the subject from Arab democracy. And one of the remarkable things about Arab Spring, I mean, we pointed this out several times, is that you hear Arab citizens criticizing their own nations and not blaming someone else for the mistakes in Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, and Syria. Yemen comes into a little bit of a different category there, but you've heard real citizen social and political criticism of their own citizens without blaming the United States or the Europeans or the Israelis. And what happened, whether, you know, it was generated by Palestinian militants or encouraged by the Syrian government, was an attempt to try to shift the subject, saying, oh, don't look at us. Let's take a look at what the Israelis are doing wrong to everyone else. Now, let's talk tactics for just a second, the tactical situation on the ground. Jim brought up about how narrow Israel is without the West Bank. That's the Netanya corridor. In other places, it shrinks to 9 or 10 miles wide. I mean, that's 105 artillery range. And I've been up on the Golan Heights overlooking Galilee. You can't really put artillery on the military crest up there, but you still have positions where even, you know, World War II era, Russian long-range guns, like 130-millimeter cannons up on the from positions on Golan Heights can fire those long-range shells almost all the way to the coast. And certainly using more modern artillery pieces that, with base bleed ammunition, you can hit you can hit virtually any target in the northern quarter of Israel with artillery. And if you've got barrage rockets, some of the longer range ones that the Iranians have been producing based on old Soviet models. I mean, you could, that's a place you can just rain death on Israel all day and all night. And that's what the Israelis say, or, Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, said, there have been changes on the ground. Changes, real changes. He's talking about demographic changes, but technology's changed over the years as well. And the Israelis have been on the receiving end of all these rockets fired by Palestinians, by Hezbollah, operating in many ways as Iranian proxies, but they're firing away at Israel. The Israelis aren't going to put up with it. That's part of the intransigence there on the Israeli part. It's a question of terrain, also a question of technology, but the real problem, and Jim alluded to it, is that you've got these Arab regimes that are based on their own basic principles, dedicated to the destruction of Israel. Anyway, Israel's a useful enemy to these regimes, and that's why I said they often try to change the subject. What's interesting is that they haven't succeeded in doing it.
So. Right. Now, Libya has basically come to a standstill at this point, right, Jim?
Yes.
And so we're stalemated there. Syria is stalemated. Now, I haven't heard much about what's happening.
I disagree with that on Libya a little bit. I know where the front lines are, but take a look at all of the defections that have occurred from Colonel Gaddafi's regime within the last 10-12 days. Significant senior officer defections, diplomatic defections, and that's not a stalemate. That's a withering of his political withering of his regime. So, I mean,
but he's willing to fight to the end because he's made so many enemies. He's not getting any love, as it were, as in terms of, being able to keep his, I mean, they found over $50 billion of Libyan government money accessible only by members of the Gaddafi clan all over the world. And of course everybody's talking war crimes indictments. So he's got nowhere to go. Not to say he won't eventually get destroyed, but he's got every incentive to stretch it out as long as possible.
And that's the same with the Syrian president, too.
Well, the Syrians have made more friends over the years. They might be able to finesse their way out of it. The Assad family. But yeah, you're right. They're in basically the same situation. It's a family dynasty which has fallen upon hard times and, is basically facing obliteration.
Right. And their biggest allies are Iran, and then also their former ally, Iraq, is gone for them.
Yes, there's been bad blood between the two of them for a long time, you know, both politically and otherwise. The fact that they were the host of most of the Saddam supporters who were supporting and financing the terror campaign, you know, 2005-2007, will not be forgotten soon in Iraq. But they've been making nice to everybody they can, but they've just been cut off, Libya's just been cut off by Russia. And Syria is probably not too far behind. Iran either has to save them or, you know, suffer tremendous losses. So the fact that they have Iran as an ally who really needs Syria to, you know, stay in the game as far as the, you know, the Iranians are concerned, puts them way ahead of, you know, the Qaddafi clan situation. The Qaddafis are toast. I mean, they're basically, you know, out in the desert without any water.
Right.
Syria has a lot more options.
In France, the traditional place for ex-Arab leaders to go is basically not there anymore, right?
No. Europeans have, drawn up that escape, you know, road. But places like Iran, which actually has, upper-class amenities, on a Western scale, that's not the worst place. You know, it's certainly preferable to a jail cell up in, Belgium.
Now, the other Arab countries, specifically those in the actual Arabian Peninsula and off the Horn and like that, or in the Arabian Peninsula, what is happening? There hasn't been much coming out about Saudi Arabia. There was some commotion in Bahrain.
The ones that have money have passed it around. You know, I'll never forget a story, an old guy I knew, you know, who worked for the Special Forces over in Vietnam, and out in the jungle one night he was arguing with a South Vietnamese Special Forces captain who he considered a smart man, a good man, and he was complaining about all the corruption in South Vietnam, which was certainly true. And the South Vietnamese captain looks at him, he says, look, there's no difference between Vietnam and America, except in America, you have enough graft to go around. Now, that's the principle that the rulers in Arabia have followed. The problem in Bahrain, where you still get some news, is that the argument isn't over money, it's over religion. A Shia majority being run by a Sunni minority who controls all the money. In Yemen, there is no money. So they're basically, fighting over the crumbs that are there. But all the rest of the country, especially Saudi Arabia, they've done a virtuoso job of buying everybody off. I mean, that's basically what it comes down to. You ask any Saudi, especially you get a few drinks in them, which I know is, you know, non-Islamic, but it works. They'll tell you that, you know, how do you fight money?
Right.
And the Saudis were smart enough not to buy guns, but to buy stuff people want. Housing, government jobs, cars, you know, shopping malls, you name it. It works.
Jobs.
Yeah, jobs. I mean, that's the next election in the United States. It's all a matter of jobs and
right.
goodies.
Right.
If the current, administration can't deliver them, we vote another bunch of, rapscallions in and see how they can do.
Right. Now, there is a sort of a focus point coming in September with the Egypt elections and then also the proposition that's going to be put forward in the UN to have a Palestinian state established in Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem.
Right,
how is
Egyptian,
that all going to
boost the Egyptian your thing, the problem there, as well as to a lesser extent in Tunisia, but in all the Arab Spring, rebellions, is how do you avoid getting a bunch, as the song goes, new bosses, same as the old bosses? Because all the people who support it, the henchmen, as it were, are all scrambling to make sure that not so much one of them becomes the new boss, but they are still henchmen. In other words, the same corrupt, manipulative, I'll do anything boss, crew. And a lot of them, in the Soviet Union, a lot of these guys survived after World War II in Japan and Germany. You know, the Nazis, the operatives, the apparatchiks, whatever you want to call them, they survived. They were still. They made themselves, useful. They were still needed, and they got to retire on a pension. Although a few ended up, hung or in front of a firing squad. But that was the minority, and the henchmen of Mubarak and Qaddafi and all these other guys They know that. And well, that's what most Egyptians are trying to avoid, because most Egyptians are aware that Mubarak didn't do all this damage by himself. He had plenty of assistance, and they want to get the assistance. But the assistants are like cockroaches. You know, Mubarak was a big target. You could catch him, but the cockroaches are going to go run and hide when you come looking for them, and the minute you turn your back, they're going to be out there picking your pocket again. That's going to be the next, you know, level of warfare, and that's going to be a lot murkier. That's going to be even harder for the media, you know, to describe, as it were, to report on. You know, a huge demonstration, that's easy. But how do you, you know, do a story on thousands of corrupt officials, you know, trying to wheedle their way back into power?
But, Jim, that is going on, and that's what I referred to when I was talking about the Tunisian situation of saying, let's make sure that the old elites are not remaining in control.
Right, and how much media attention is that getting?
It is. What you just nailed, of course, is that now you've got to be somebody who's really interested in following the story to see the path, because, hey, to have somebody write an essay and point out that this fellow was corrupt under Ben Ali and he's going to be corrupt now, and hell, he's just the old regime recast, that's not as exciting as people throwing bricks and, you know, somebody heaving a firebomb. I'm talking about from a television producer's perspective, heaving a firebomb at a police truck. I mean, what's going on now, though, that's what I mean about the long-term struggle, Dan, and that's what I mean about having effects the next five or six decades. They either try to root out the corrupt henchmen. But I'll tell you what, it is being covered. It just doesn't get the attention, you know?
Yeah, because it isn't exciting. That's why even in the United States, if there's sex involved with a politician's political scandal, it gets lots of attention. But something as trivial as, you know, graft and, you know, selling contracts and it's not. I mean, you know, I've spoken to, you know, news people, news directors and the anchors, and they complain, you know, the stuff that's really doing the damage, you get no traction.
Right.
That applies to photos on Facebook. That's what you need to do. That'll get you attention all the time, man. So.
We don't cover graft and corruption in Chicago. Why should we do it in Egypt?
does get covered, Dan. The thing is, though, it gets covered by, you know, a very small group. Segment of the citizenry that's actually interested in what's going on. But that said, you've got to have the scandal accelerator to attract at least legacy media attention. You know?
Right.
That's one of the benefits of the blogosphere that, some news professionals now begrudgingly admit is that, you know, there are bloggers out there that actually do know something and they cover it. There are plenty that are just polemicists and rhetoricians, but there aren't bloggers out there that know quite a bit, and they look into these things. You can find it. I'm going to repeat something that Dunnigan said just a few minutes ago. Plus, with Google Translator, you can get a sense of it in the original language, and you're not relying on a translation.
Right. And there are a lot of Arab speakers that are now living in...
I mean, a translation by somebody who might have a bias.
Right.
You got the Google Translator doing it for you.
Right. Now,
I've managed to keep some of my Arabic-speaking friends honest by just casually mentioning Google Translate. I mean, I've had them translate some things, and I've later checked and found a few things got a little toned down. I mean, these are westernized, you know, I call them bicultural Arabs, and they're a little embarrassed about some of the crap that goes down, you know, back home.
Oh, it's absolutely vicious. It's vicious, and you can find, and I'm blanking out on this, but I know that I've seen at least two sites that are Israeli sites where they provide, you know, some in translation from Arabic press, and it's just what Jim described. Of course, the accusation would be that, well, the Israeli translators are making it worse.
I know that site. They give you a reference to the Arabic site.
Yeah.
I believe they give a reference, a link to the Arabic site. You can go look for yourself.
Yeah, that's right.
Pretty legit. I think even Obama has looked at that and been rather appalled at what is going on. Even the Arabist, the Arabic lobby, which is fairly strong in the State Department, was a little embarrassed by that particular information access by the president.
I've seen stuff off of their television that's been translated that is just horrific.
They don't pull any punches.
Well, and then
they report on Chicago politics.
Even some of their children's programming is.
They encourage kids to become suicide bombers.
Right.
I mean,
let's finish up just with some comments on what's going to happen with the UN proposal this September with Israel.
Nothing.
Because
you'll have the symbolic action and hydrogen of the UN that the Israelis going to.
The ultimate end game here is the UN is going to be called upon to provide peacekeepers to force Israel to do something. Nobody wants to be put into that situation.
Now,
nobody even wants to be asked. The UN resolution, 6666, specifies that the UN must, do something, and we're asking France and Germany and, the usual suspects to provide troops to go into Israel. No.
Now, does the United States have any veto power over this?
Yes, everybody in the Security Council. Sure, we'll veto it, but the mere fact that they bring it up, and vote on it, they depend upon our veto. That's been going on for a long time. The other Western countries, they can basically beat on Israel and even vote against Israel, knowing that we'll come in just like we, pay a lot of their defense bills for the last 50 years. We will come in and make sure the right thing is done. And they can blame us for that, too.
This is something for us to revisit definitely, Dan, after it occurs. Because the fact that this is going to go to the UN is going to put the current U.S. Administration, the Obama administration, there are a number of pressures on the Obama administration. The U.S. casts that veto. They get hit internationally. Same. Obama is...
a lot of Europeans are praying to death that Obama might not veto it. The resolution. Because it's the Europeans who have been putting this anti-Israel thing, not the United States. The United States could basically abstain from the vote and tell the Europeans, all right, you wanted it, you got it, you deal with it.
Right.
And that's the last thing the Europeans want.
Well, there's some other elements of it. If the Obama administration doesn't do it, what does that do with certain voting factions within the
Democratic Party? He's going to count votes. It's all a matter of counting, and I think pretty much that the Jewish lobby can mobilize more oomph on, in the primaries than the far-left wackos.
Well,
anti-Semitic block.
This is why this would be an interesting subject to return to, Dan.
Right.
It's all a matter of, not embarrassing the president during the primaries.
Right.
Right. Well, we'll wrap it up with that, and I'm sure we'll revisit the hot Arab summer over the summer. And hopefully it gets a little bit warmer where I live at, because we've been having winter weather all the way through May. So,
summer is a big subject, Dan, and this is big history.
All right,
but we should end with not forgetting that after summer comes fall and winter, and the Arabs are concerned about that too.
Right.
The Arab winter might be the ultimate, story to end the current, exciting stuff.
Right. All right.
Till next time.
Till next time. Bye.
Bye, guys.